earl had been convicted of murder since 1760. The idea of a murder taking place in that tall, white, incredibly elegant, formal house, and behind, you know, that's screening this mayhem. It's got that tension which fascinates us about murder between the facade and what went on behind.
Half a century has passed since one of Britain's most infamous murders. What do we know about Lord Lucan? And what is just legend?
It's a myth. The Lucan myth is so powerful. And I absolutely bought into it. And I'm not saying there aren't elements of truth in it, but what it is incredibly satisfying narrative. It's a cathartic narrative. This man, this entitled, arrogant, privileged man who revealed himself to be the lowest of the low.
The prime suspect, a peer of the realm, the lord who vanishes. Is it time to re-evaluate the killing of Lucan's nanny, Sandra Rivett?
Just to talk to people who knew him, who called him John, who could just fill this case in. And so from the myth, it became very much a book about a marriage, his marriage to Veronica. But what I also learned was that you cannot kill a myth.
My name's Robert Murphy. This is Behind the Crimes. Behind the Crimes is the podcast that tells you about the biggest or most interesting cases from people who were involved. Victims, detectives, experts, and sometimes even the criminals themselves. For more than 20 years, I've covered some of Britain's highest profile crime stories for television news. And in this series, we're making a deep dive into each case to see how crimes were either solved or how criminals managed to evade justice. If you want to see evidence from each inquiry, watch video clips, read more, or get in touch, just subscribe. You can do that at robertmurphy.substack.com. Please do rate and review and share this podcast. It makes so much difference. Word of warning, this is a crime podcast. There might be language and descriptions and imagery you might find affecting. Listener discretion is advised. This episode is called Lord Lucan, A Different Class of Murder. Episode 1. Prelude to a Killing. This week, we have one of the biggest and most enduring crime stories in British history. It is nearly 50 years from the moment the Countess of Lucan burst into a pub at 10 at night on November the 7th, 1974, gasping the words, "Murder. Murder." Covered in blood, she had, she said, just escaped her husband's attempt to kill her. But the children's nanny had perished in a prolonged beating. The case of the vanishing Earl, Lord Lucan, the dead nanny, Sandra Rivett, the acrimonious custody battle, his powerful friends, the hapless police investigation, stunned recession-crippled 1970s Britain. It seemed to tell us something more about the country in which we lived, about the differences in fortunes if you were rich or poor. And the myths endure to this day. Over the next few episodes, this podcast will shine a new light on the murder of Sandra Rivett and its aftermath. And then we have a story of a truly dark coincidence. Laura Thompson is a distinguished and award-winning author. She's written biographies of Agatha Christie, Edith Thompson, and the Mitford sisters. She first wrote her book, A Different Class of Murder, The Story of Lord Lucan, in 2014. And for her research, she spoke with people who knew the man himself. Laura then released a second edition in 2018, following the death of Lucan's wife and presumed target, Veronica Lucan. I started by asking Laura her thoughts about the Lucan mystery and what she was able to bring to the party.
Sort of hovers in our collective consciousness. I was interested, but I also thought, what on earth am I going to say here? Because am I just going to do another rehash of the evil Earl, the wicked circle, the terrible gamblers who protected him from justice, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh, well, you know, maybe there's a good way of doing it. And then what happened just amazed me, because I approached a couple of people and I got this extraordinary response.
When you say people, you mean people who knew him, his sister, people really close, super close.
Yes. Well, it started with the Shan kids, Christina Shan Kidd, who was Lucan's sister-in-law. She was the sister of Veronica Lucan, Lady Lucan. And her husband, Bill Shankid, who was a friend of Lucan's. And I wrote to them absolutely on spec, thinking there's no way these people are going to speak to me. And then Christina rang me up and she said, yes, I would like to speak to you. There's been a lot of nonsense written about this case, and come and see us. And of course I was petrified, absolutely petrified. I smoked then, and I think I had about 20 fags before 11 in the morning. Awful, really. But I was nervous. I was nervous of speaking to all these people. But then they were lovely, quite lovely, and incredibly open, as you will know, having read the book. Yeah. I mean, the first edition, I had to take, the lawyer took most of it out. It was only when Veronica died that we did another edition, and an awful lot of it got put back in. But what it did immediately was humanize the case. And because, like I say in the book, it's a myth. The Lucan myth is so powerful. And I absolutely bought into it. And I'm not saying there aren't elements of truth in it, but what it is incredibly satisfying narrative. It's a cathartic narrative. This man, this entitled, arrogant, privileged man who revealed himself to be the lowest of the low and may have got away with it because that's what people like him do, but basically, you know, he fell from grace. And just to talk to people who knew him, who called him John, who could just fill this case in. And so from the myth, it became very much a book about a marriage, his marriage to Veronica. But what I also learned was that you cannot kill a myth.
Yes.
And in the end, I stopped doing events about Lord Lucan because just to say, you know, there is a human being here, because, you know, really would antagonise audience members. So I just gave up in the end.
Everyone knows the facts about Lord Lucan, they think. He had everything, it seemed, well, from the outside. Looks, he was incredibly handsome. Money, although not from vast riches, he had more than most and had inherited an earldom and a small fortune. He was a peer of the realm, an Edwardian caricature in a disco age. A professional gambler at London's exclusive Claremont Club, a man who had the nickname Lucky but squandered what eroding fortune he had. A man who snapped in a moment of murderous fury and killed, but not his intended target, his wife, but the family nanny, Sandra Rivett. And all of this happened behind the elegant facade of a London townhouse.
I'm a great lover of detective fiction, Golden Age detective fiction, particularly Agatha Christie, and it really does have that aspect. And it has a Cluedo aspect, you know, Lord Lucan with the lead piping in the basement. There's this sort of dehumanised aspect to it. It's almost folkloric. And because of where it, you know, no Earl had been convicted of murder since 1760. And he was convicted in absentia at an inquest. But, you know, where it happened, 46 Lower Belgrave Street, which I've walked up and down so many times, oh, my God, I must look weird. But, you know, the idea of a murder taking place in that house, which is that tall, white, incredibly elegant, formal house, and behind, you know, that's screening this mayhem that happened. You know, it's got that tension which fascinates us about murder between the facade and what went on behind. And with that, and with what he looked like, this waxwork earl, the externals are incredibly fascinating because they're not really like any other case. You know, the upper classes don't commit murder because they don't need to, because most murders are about money and they have money. But he didn't have any money, or he didn't have enough money. But what it became was a story about the marriage and about the three Lucan children. And that was what it all proceeded from, it seemed to me, and that was what I kept being told.
So who was Lord Lucan? Well, it's a quirk of the British nobility that you have two names. You have your title, in his case, Lord Lucan, and you have your birth name. His was Richard John Bingham. Everyone called him John. Bingham was born in 1934. During the Second World War, he was evacuated to the USA. After returning to England, he spent a short time at Eton College, where he seemed to find himself and a love of gambling. He was the heir to the Anglo-Irish earldom of Lucan. That had been created nearly 200 years earlier in the 1770s. Now, a quick potted lesson about the British nobility. Beneath the king or queen, who is sovereign, you have assorted layers of aristocracy. The most important, traditionally, were dukes. Historically, they had the largest lands. Under dukes came marquesses. Halfway down were earls, and this was the layer of nobility into which Lucan was destined. And under earls were viscounts, and then barons coming in at the bottom. So the earldom was a big deal in the 1770s. But over the centuries, the family did not cover themselves in glory. His great-great-grandfather, the third earl, was a ruthless Irish lord who oversaw the eviction of more than 2,000 tenants during the Great Famine. And he managed to lead the disastrous charge of the Light Brigade in 1854. And by the time of Bingham's father, the sixth earl, most of the money had gone. And the Lucans were not well known outside London. They were definitely not household names. In fact, Lucan's parents were socialists, Labour Party activists. And as many children do, John Bingham seemed to rebel against his parents, in his case by being more right-wing, more traditional, if you like, than they were. They were progressive. He was not. After Eton, he was a lieutenant in the Coldstream Guards, leaving after a couple of years. And he tried working in the city, but that wasn't for him. He thought he could earn more in casinos, and was given the name Lucky after a sizeable but rare win. He was handsome, really handsome, tall, swarthy, with a distinguished moustache. He seemed the epitome of the English lord in training.
His facade was so powerful, you know, this. He looked like an earl from, you know, I always think of him, you know, in the days of T-Rex and what have you, and men walking around with long hair and all that, and this man who looked like something from just another age, with that slick back hair and that moustache and that guardsman's bearing. But that, you feel that the facade was what was keeping him together, because what I remember Bill Shankid saying to me, he said something like he was cripplingly lacking in confidence. And I also met Lucan's sister, who lived in New York, who was really quite lovely, and very upset about the whole thing still. That was what kept coming across, actually, this distress still. And not just about him, about the girl who died, Sandra Rivett, you know, the horror of what happened, the nanny. But she, you know, his sister painted a picture of a very mixed up, turbulent individual who'd had psychological problems as a child. But then when he went to Eton, surprise, surprise, he sort of found his niche, found his people, as it were. And, you know, he then went into the city, but he gave up the city because he had a huge win at Latuka and decided he could be a professional gambler, which again is sort of like playing out this part of like an earl from an earlier age. And he just seemed like he felt hollow. He felt a bit like a fantasist almost. But I was also told he was clever. But I did wonder whether he was gay, actually, and couldn't admit it. Mm. But he just should never have married Veronica. But as soon as you start talking like this, and I'm very aware of it, it sounds like you're making excuses for this awful person who most likely did kill. And it does sound like you're making excuses and you become like an apologist for all the wrong things, you know, posh people, privileged people, men, white men, you know, it just, the whole thing becomes very, very difficult in an age of identity politics, where what Lucan is about the category of person that you really can attack with impunity. Most people you can't, but you can him. So he was a very satisfying hate figure, I imagine, in 1974 when everyone was broke and the lights kept going off and, you know, three-day week, strikes, IRA, you know, and there's this man in the middle of it all. I should think it was very satisfying to pour your frustration with society onto him. What I was told was he had everything going for him and was completely incapable of realizing these assets he had. So he retreated into this kind of antique persona of the gambling earl. I mean, it's ridiculous, really, but lots of people did speak fondly of him. But I know exactly what people would say. They'd say, well, he was like, they were like him. They were posh. They stuck to their own.
John Bingham met Veronica Duncan in January 1963. Now, he still wasn't Lord Lucan yet. His father was still alive. She was 25 years old, short, slender, blonde, and very striking. Veronica was smart and artistic. She'd gone to art college, but now she and her sister, Christina, were living in London. You recall that Christina was one of the people who spoke to Laura for her research with the book. And Christina and her husband introduced Veronica to John Bingham.
His life was fine until he got married. Veronica was, she was born in 1937. She was a very pretty girl, which, you know, then, you know, you were going to get married. That was the way one thought about these things. But she clearly should have had a career. She was very clever. She absolutely should have gone to university. You know, done something. She did want to get married, and Christina married Bill Shankid, who was a well-to-do man and not a faithful husband, but they all sort of seemed to take that as part of the deal. And he was pretty marvellous when I met him. I mean, he was a quadriplegic. He'd had a terrible accident, but he was very charismatic, very interesting. Anyway, through Bill and Christina, Veronica met Luke and John Bingham, as he then was. So this is kind of 1963. And he seems to have, it reminds me a little bit of the way they describe as Prince Charles, as he then was, with Diana, you know, when they would, she would sort of be quiet and rather docile and sort of seem to understand this rather, possibly rather vain, slightly not very confident man.
Veronica was not from what might loosely be called the establishment, but people who knew her thought her entitled.
You do get this sort of feminist reading of the case, whereby the she sort of triumphs over this pillar of the establishment, but she actually really did want to marry him, and she did enjoy being a countess, and she would, I mean, she had, her sister told me she had a terrible row with Christina's nanny because she hadn't called her milady and she stormed out of the house. Mm-hmm. So she had quite a powerful sense of titles and what it meant to have one. She too had been a troubled child and had seen a child psychiatrist. It's almost like there's this weird bond between them until everything went wrong. again, her sister told me this, but it's hard to explain. Christina was very conflicted in what she was saying. I did wonder whether she was saying a lot of this to me for the sake of the children, the three Lucan children, who really have had, I mean, they all lead extremely successful lives, but it's a hell of a thing to grow up with. Whether she wanted to put this more balanced view, trusted me to write it.
Things moved quickly after the wedding. 2 months later, John's father died and he, John, became the seventh Earl of Lucan and started drawing an inheritance. He and Veronica had the first of their three children later in 1964. A daughter, Frances, was born in October. George followed in 67 and in 1970 along came Camilla. Now, remember Frances, the eldest, because she was 10 years old in 1974 and is an important witness to the events after the murder. Despite the smart address, them being a beautiful couple and their three wonderful children, their marriage by the end of the 1960s and early 70s was falling apart, and in the most awful way.
I don't think he particularly wanted to get married, but of course he had to have an heir. And so it happened in this almost casual way. And I think he probably liked the fact that she was related to Bill Shankey, because I think he rather thought an awful lot of Bill. And they got married in November 1963. And then very shortly afterwards, he inherited the earldom, which was probably a bit of a disaster. As with any bad marriage, there are two versions of events. And what strikes me about this case, or certainly struck me as soon as I started talking to people who'd actually known these people, nobody was saying, oh, this guy's so great, you know, she was awful. They were just fleshing it out, explaining it, giving it a background. So they were giving the other side of events that had never really been heard, because of him disappearing in November 1974, we've only ever heard Veronica's version of events. And it's taken as truth, but in fact, a lot of it is uncorroborated. You know, there's so much about this case that we simply do not know. It may be true, but it may not be true. So her version of how the marriage disintegrated was that she had to go to the Claremont Club where he gambled in Berkeley Square, and it was absolutely hideous and everyone was foul to her. And he was gambling and he shouldn't have been. I wanted him to do sensible things, even though she knew perfectly well that he was a gambler when they got married. And then he tried to tell her this is the key thing. He tried to tell her she was going mad and took her off to a psychiatrist and she ran away. He was trying to make her believe that there was something terribly wrong with her and that she was, why he would have done this, I don't know, unless it was with a view to later getting custody of the children. But this was all going on years before any of that happened. So it was, and her friend, a very good friend of hers, said to me, you know, she was always saying, oh, he's trying to make out I'm mad, he's trying to make out I'm mad. And the friend said, well, she was quite odd. But it came to the point of whether you believe that he was making her that way, or whether you believe what her sister and other people told me, that she was a little bit mentally unstable anyway, and that clearly he was not the kind of husband that was going to help you with anything like that. Again, it's a bit Charles and Diana somehow, I feel, you know, that she had mental health, she admitted, you know, and you need a very particular type of man, I think, to deal with those things. And Lucan sure as hell was not that person. But they went on together. Then there was this great incident at the Claremont Club, where she threw a glass of wine in some woman's face, which in that world was like seismic, you know. It was like breaking the facade, which you do not do, of course. And then she got rid of the nanny, the children's nanny, because she thought he was too close to Lucan. And then Lucan left.
He left
home. He left in January 1973. And you can see it from both sides. You can see that from his point of view, it was just a complete nightmare and it was untenable. And you can see that from her point of view, she was distressed and needed help and she wasn't getting it.
Was Veronica unwell? Was Lord Lucan gaslighting his wife? Were both things happening? No one knows for sure now, as they didn't back then. Laura Thompson has just mentioned the Clermont Club. This also has a part to play in the story, and it's worth us spending a few moments on this extraordinary place. Later, after the murder, the Clermont Set, as they were known, would be accused of helping Lucan escape. The Clermont Club was established at 44 Berkeley Square in the upmarket Mayfair district of London in 1962. It was a historic and beautiful building which had been derelict and unloved for years. It was developed by John Aspinall, a man who had won a change in the law to make gambling establishments legal in the UK. Aspinall was a curious and charismatic mix of a man. He was a conservationist. He owned a zoo and would often be seen roaming the gaming tables with a tiger cub on a lead. Unlike Lucan, he was a self-made man and he had a huge sense of self. There were others: James Goldsmith, the financier and tycoon; David Stirling, who had created the Special Air Service, or SAS, in the Second World War; and Jim Slater, one of the UK's first corporate raiders, a man who terrified old family companies the length and breadth of Britain. They were nouveau riche, fast living and daring, and they loved being around establishment figures from old families like Lucan. And what Lucan lacked in ready money, he made up for in status for these new rich kids on the block. He, Lucan, got to spend his evenings with these energetic masters of the universe, and the chief master was John Aspinall.
John Aspinall, I mean, fascinating man, really, did more damage than anybody in this case, I think, because he would never stop talking to the press and sort of massively a part of formulating that myth. You know, he was the man who got gambling law reformed, or the Betting and Gaming Act of 1960, before which you couldn't, you know, you could gamble, but gambling premises were illegal. And the Clermont Club was a casino. Oh, my goodness. It's quite extraordinary what he created there, really. Mm. This incredibly beautiful house on Berkeley Square, 18th century house. And of course, what it's really about is people going there and losing their money to John Aspinall. But he tricked it out with this extraordinary 18th century aura of, you know, the beauty of the house, the food, the wine, these marvellous looking women, the smartness, the ambiance of the whole thing, the fun of the whole thing. And of course, it made them even more inclined to chuck money around, like aristocrats used to do in the 18th century, where you would throw dice, lose thousands, and then say, it's a pleasure to lose it, which somebody did, in fact, say after losing £40,000. It's just, so he recreated that ambience and made them feel that it was, you know, an elite thing to do. But in the 60s, certainly, I think it was jolly good fun there. Mm. You know, it wasn't just poshos. It was Elizabeth Taylor. It was Frank Sinatra. It was Mick Jagger. It was Ian Fleming. It was, for a time, it was the place to be. And it's certainly an incredibly beautiful, beautiful place. And the parties were amazing. And the story, you know, he would come this marvellous spiral staircase leading down, and he came down there with a tiger on a lead. Because, of course, he was a great wildlife conservationist on top of everything else, John Aspinall. He was a buccaneer. He did things the way he chose to do them. It was frightful in many ways, but I sort of can't help have a sneaking admiration for just the way he went at life. Mm-hmm. When they talk about Lucan's circle of friends, as these rich and powerful masters of the universe. They were gamblers who'd lost more or less everything. By the early 1970s, most of them had no money at all and were paid to sit there. Yeah. When the club was sold to Playboy in 1972.
And Lucan was called Lucky, wasn't he? Rather ironically, as it was towards the end of his gambling career.
That is just ludicrous. I spoke to a man, Stuart Wheeler, a very good gambler himself, and he was quite interesting about it all, about James Goldsmith playing power games. And Lucan, he said, yes, he was a good backgammon player. He was quite a good bridge player. You know, you could imagine that you could earn, win money. And of course, you wouldn't pay tax on it with tax levels as they were at that time. But he became, I think as the marriage got more and more difficult, he just spent more and more time there. And somebody told me, he'd swing by my office at about 11:30, have his first drink, probably not having been up that long, and then go to the Claremont and then somewhere else and then go back to the Claremont. It became like a home from home, which is very, very dangerous when you're there basically with the possibility of losing large amounts of money.
Instead of being at home with his wife and children, Lucan spent his time in the casino with his friends and fellow gamblers. And his marriage collapsed around him in a series of acrimonious court battles over the three children.
There were two custody hearings. There's what they call an ex parte, where you only hear one side, and he won that, which I was told by someone who'd been in family law at the time. He said that's very unusual. Mm. He must have had pretty strong evidence against her. So then I said to this man, but hang on, in July, she won at the full hearing. And he said, oh, yes, but that's, you can write reports saying that someone's no longer mentally incapacitated, or you can say I was only mentally incapacitated because of him, and now he's gone. And she had a psychiatrist from the Priory who said she'll be fine as long as she takes lithium. It's not that reassuring, is it? And then Christina, the sister, said, because she felt very torn, she said, no, I think Veronica should have custody, but there must be a good live-in nanny all the time, which didn't really happen in any proper, stable way. And Christina said, I then went round to the house and it was just a disaster. There was this frightful nanny. She cooked a pheasant, it was frozen inside. It was all just, she just couldn't cope. Not her fault, she couldn't cope. And she said, I blame the judge who gave her custody. I blame him for all of it. And that was when Lucan's financial problems really started, because he lost about 20,000 on that case. And what he really wanted to do was get the judgment overturned. And he had a very good barrister, James Comyn, who was not some sort of, you know, the way this case has been written about, particularly at the time, all these people saying, oh, God, he was, you know, the most evil man who ever lived, and anyone who backed him. Well, his barrister was a very, very, very sound top man who firmly believed that he should get the judgment overturned. But of course, his lifestyle didn't sound very good. And of course, Veronica said some very, very terrible things about him at the hearing. He was a sadist, a physical sadist, a sexual sadist and everything, which everybody believes. And it may well be true. And I don't wish to say it's not true, but there is no proof. Then what happened after that was and again, you get these two ways of portraying the same events. He had private detectives watching the house. He himself would watch the house. He used to ring up and try and tape her phone calls. And of course, people would say, well, that's because he was a stalker. He was a monster. From his point of view, he was trying to get evidence to get the judgment overturned. But doing it in a very, I freely admit, a very unnerving way. It must have been hell to be Veronica at that time. the whole thing is just, you know, it, what it made me feel is so unnecessary, all of it. Mm. If I, you know, when marriages become these terrible, terrible, terrible battles, and you as an outsider just think, oh, for God's sake, why can't you just, you know, cool it and be reasonable and talk, you know, work it out. But of course, people can't when they're, I mean, I've been in that position. It brings out the absolute worst in you. And that's what they were like. But I mean, he had these private detectives do a report on some nanny who, her idea of nannying was to take the children to the Irish club in, I think, Eaton Square. And she was drinking from about midday while the children... I mean, I think Lucan was within his rights to protest about that. The children were wards of court. And he was... I think he was within his rights. But again, it's been portrayed, certainly by the police at the time and by most of the press, as a campaign of intimidation, harassment against this woman whose only crime was to have married a monster.
So as summer 1974 was turning into autumn, Veronica and the three children were in the family home. Lucan was renting his own place around the corner. He spent most of his time in the casino with his friends. He'd won, then lost a legal fight over his children's custody, which had cost him a fortune. He had no money and was trying to win the thousands he needed for legal fees back on the gaming tables. Lucan was angry, humiliated, and broke. And I think now is the time to talk about the nanny. And, for reasons I hope to explore later, we need to talk not just about Sandra Rivett, the nanny who was murdered. But I also want to talk about Sandra's predecessor, Christabel Boyce. Now, she'd left the Lucan service just a few weeks earlier, but notes that she had written helped the police inquiry later.
Christabel Boyce, as she became, and she had kept these diaries of things that Veronica had told her. Veronica had fed her this, again, as I say, may well be the absolute truth, told her about Lucan, told her what happened on the night of the murder and the how Lucan had suggested a suicide pact, which seemed unlikely to me, but you never know. And all this kind of thing. And Christabel had written all this down, absolutely 100% on Veronica's side. They were very close.
I would really like you just describe to me, I guess in some ways, the most important person in this story, and that's Sandra Rivett.
Yes.
Just give us an idea about who she was, what she was like, and her relationship with Veronica Lucan. Because she had only been there, really, hadn't she, for a very short period of time before November 74?
Yes, she'd been there 10 weeks. And they found one of her suitcases still not wholly unpacked, which is just, I found that terribly distressing. She too had had mental health issues, Sandra. Don't know whether it was depression or whatever. She'd grown up in sort of Croydon, around that sort of area. And she'd had a series of different jobs. She got married to Roger Rivett, who is... the true gentleman of this case, I think, because he's never said one word about her. But that didn't last. She ended up at Lower Belgrave Street, where she seems to have been a success. I believe, well, Christina Shankid told me the children liked her very much. Veronica liked her. Apparently they would go out for a drink together, et cetera, et cetera. She had two children herself. She had one son who was brought up by her parents and believed that Sandra was his older sister, which I think happened quite commonly then, and only found out later, poor man. And she had another son who was given away at birth, who is now Neil Berryman, who is the man who has made it sort of his life's work to find Lucan.
Yes.
She seems to have had a very sunny, pleasant nature. She, out of her marriage, she was enjoying life. She had a few boyfriends, which the press were a tiny bit censorious about at the time.
So Sandra Rivett was in the Lucan family home on the night of November the 7th, 1974. The events that followed have been pored over for 50 years. But it was just by chance that she, the nanny, was there.
It was meant to be Sandra's night off. It was a Thursday. The 7th was a Thursday. But she didn't take the night off. There's conflicting reasons as to why. But so she was in the house with Veronica, the three children, and they were all upstairs, so on the second floor of Veronica's bedroom, from the time of Top of the Pops. This is it. It all goes by television programs. They were watching Top of the Pops. They were watching The $6 Million Man. And then at 9 o'clock, they were watching the BBC News. They were on the bed watching television, all of them, Sandra as well. And then Frances goes upstairs to her own room, comes back down again. Sandra went downstairs to the basement to make some tea. But according to Frances, she went down at about 8:40. And according to Veronica, she went down 9-ish. The basement was, it's one of those very tall, thin London houses. And the basement, there was no light bulb in the socket of the basement. So it's extraordinary, really, that she went down these very narrow stairs carrying a tray of old dirty teacups, I suppose, in the dark.
Next time, what happened in the basement of the Lucan family home in Lower Belgrave Street? Who was down there? Do we really know for sure? Was it Lord Lucan or a hired assassin?
And then, in the basement, somebody attacked her very viciously.
The moment a countess screamed out that something truly awful had happened.
She burst in there at 10 to 10 and then screamed, "Murder, murder."
Are there any clues to what happened to the disappearing lord?
It's still something that people ponder over, theorise about. Was he got away? Did he kill himself? You know, did John Aspinall manage to magic up a plane from somewhere?
And a floundering police inquiry combines with Lucan's powerful friends.
It's a very good cover for the Met. They could say, well, we haven't solved this because nobody will tell us anything. They all say, no, you can't come around and talk to me now. I'm going skiing for 3 weeks or whatever. Well, the people I spoke to weren't like that at all.
The next episode will be available next week. Check the show notes to get details of Laura Thompson's book, A Different Class of Murder, The Story of Lord Lucan. If you found this episode compelling, please subscribe to robertmurphy.substack.com, where you can get extras, video clips, and read more.